What's cracking, folks? Welcome back to Podcast Paroxysm. I'm Jared Dubin. I am back in New York City, and we've got Jordan White online. Jordan just moved to Denver, and he finally has internet, so we're podcasting again. What's up, Jordan?
Nothing, Jared. Just trying to find a place to live. You know, the usual.
Do we want to tell the story of how you got screwed out of an apartment before we start?
You know what? I don't think the listeners really care about that. Plus, it just takes me to a bad place, and we don't want to go to that bad place. So let's go to the good place and talk about basketball.
We'll go to the good place, but we will, before we go there, we will say that you did consider burning down that apartment.
I can neither confirm nor deny any of those actions.
I might have talked you out of committing arson.
I don't even know if you talked me out of it. More talked me into delaying my plans, hypothetically
speaking. Right. We'll say, for now, that I talked you out of it.
Okay, fine.
All right, today we're going to talk about three Eastern Conference teams that pretty much everyone almost universally agrees are going to make a jump this year. We're going to talk about the Cavs, the Pistons, and the Wizards. We're going to start off with the Cavs. They had the number one pick this year. They also had the number one pick 2 years ago, so they've got Kyrie Irving, and they picked Tristan Thompson in the same draft at four with Kyrie Irving. Then at four the next year, they picked a surprise, Dion Waiters, and then they picked another surprise with the first pick in the draft this year, Anthony Bennett. The Cavs are surprising. Nobody ever knows what they're going to do.
Right. They were the ones that instigated the chaos of this year's draft, which was one of the most chaotic, also one of the most fun drafts in years. But no one thought they were going to take Bennett. Like, no one saw that coming. And so the moment that pick came in, just like everything went to shit. And it was awesome to see. The Bennett pick, I'll say this for the Cavs, they pick who they want. They're not going to be taken in by, you know, what everybody else thinks of another player. If it's a guy they like, and if that guy's available there, then you know what? They're going to take him. Now, if that person that they liked was like a lower first round talent, then they weren't going to take him with the number one pick. But Bennett was in consideration for the number one pick.
I don't remember really seeing him talked about as the number one. I remember seeing him.
He was always the dark horse. He was always considered like a top four. There were always like rumblings about him as maybe the number one pick, but there was never really like serious.
Pretty much everyone had it down to Nerlens Noel or Alex Len by the time draft day came around.
Right, exactly.
Nobody was really seriously talking about Bennett as the number one pick.
Otto Porter, like, maybe. Right.
I don't think I heard anything about him in the last, like, 3 weeks even remotely related to being the number one pick. But that just shows you
some dark horse stuff.
I'm not sure I remember that. Maybe you read more stuff than I did about it, because I just didn't particularly care. But I think mainly, I agree with you there. They just take who they want without regard for where necessarily the guy is projected to be drafted. They did it with Tristan Thompson. They did it with Waiters. And now they did it with Bennett. And, I mean, one of the things that I think is really interesting about them, they have so many different front court combinations they can play now.
Yeah.
Between, because, you know, they drafted Bennett and Thompson in the last 3 years each. They drafted Tyler Zeller in the middle of the first round last year. They still have Anderson Varejão, and they signed Andrew Bynum. They've got so many different combinations they can play, and you know, all different combinations of offense, defense. I mean, I would think that probably at the start of the season you're going to see, as long as they're healthy, Bynum and Varejão start together.
See, there's your thing, though. Health is a huge thing for this team, like maybe more than any other team. Like, the Timberwolves were that team last year where they had the injury bug, but the Cavs, a lot of their players, I hate the word injury prone, but some of their players have, you know, they have injury issues. Anderson Varejão, he always seems to have like really good productive years, but he does get hurt quite a bit. Kyrie Irving, some health issues. I don't know, like, how warranted the worries are about the those issues, because they always kind of seem to be in different places. It could just be a frail body overall, which, you know,
that might actually be worse.
Right, exactly.
I don't think you can call it anything else other than injury prone for guys like Varejão and Bynum, though.
No,
those guys are just hurt all the time. They're injury prone. With Kyrie, it's been, you know, a lot of people are saying, oh, they're kind of fluke freak injuries. Maybe they are, maybe they're not, but you can't deny that, you know, at Duke he had injury problems. His first year in the league he had injury problems, and last year he had missed a bunch of games as well. There's a pattern developing, though we don't know if it'll hold. Obviously, some guys, you know, start their career getting injured a bunch, and then it kind of fades away. Hopefully that happens with Kyrie, but you never know.
And you see, that's the thing. Like, Kyrie is, right now, yeah, he's been hurt a lot, but he's also 2-3 years in a NBA strength and conditioning program. So you've got to think that the coaches on that end will see what the problem is, if there is a problem, and work to correct that. I mean, maybe that's putting a bit more faith in the trainers than I should, because, you know, any trainer who's not, like, the Phoenix Suns trainers, got to be a little worried, not worried about, but, you know, but, yeah, I like those front courts, or I don't know if I like them. I'm intrigued by those front court, whatever, hodgepodge, you could say. My one worry is Bynum, just because I don't think you can rely on him to, you know,
eat anything. Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. Is he even going to be ready for the start of the season?
Is there still no timetable on him? That was the last I saw.
I still don't think there's a timetable on him. And this, like, his knees are bad. His knees are bad. You can't spin it any other way.
Yeah, as of 6 days ago, Andrew Bynum has no idea what his return schedule will be.
Right. So I get why his cash fans are like, you know what, it's still a good contract. You know, we have really no risk. Well,
they didn't guarantee him basically really any money. Like, if you pay with a team in their cap situation, let's say the Bynum thing doesn't work and he doesn't even get on the court. Okay, so they paid $6 million, you know, to possibly get Andrew Bynum this season. And if it doesn't work out, not a big deal. All it costs them is Dan Gilbert's money. If he can get on the court, obviously it would be a big help. You know, they didn't really have much in the way of front court scoring or anybody that could kind of command defensive attention last season once Varejão went down.
Right.
Tristan Thompson could score a little bit, but most of his offensive production is coming off cuts and offensive rebounds, and not necessarily a guy who's, you know, either sucking defenders in on the pick and roll that much, or, you know, gonna post up and draw defenders that way. So
right,
no, Bynum gives them
on that end.
Right. Bynum gives them a whole different dimension, and I think
hypothetically,
a healthy Bynum gives them a whole different dimension, I should say.
Yes.
And I think Anthony Bennett, you know, as much as I may not have, you know, selected him with the number one pick, I probably would take in Nerlens Noel. Shout out to Conrad. He gives them a different dimension too, as a pick and pop shooter, which they didn't really have last year either. Once Varejão can do it from the free throw line area, but Bennett's kind of even more of an outside shooter, and that gives them a dimension they didn't have last year either.
Yeah, Bennett gives him better range just overall. If, you know, if he's able to replicate that range,
right. And then they also signed Earl Clark this summer, who, while before last season didn't look like much of anything anywhere, when he got into D'Antoni's spread system, he became a bit of a small ball four floor spacer type.
He did some things.
Yeah, he's not going to shoot, you know, 38-39% from three, but if he can shoot 35-36% from out there, it's respectable, I guess, and, you know, it'll draw somebody. If it draws someone even a step further out of the lane, that's that much more space for Kyrie and for Waiters and for, you know, Bynum if he's healthy and Varejão if he's healthy.
Yeah.
Let's talk about Kyrie, obviously, because he's just so good. And Ian's got something going
on. He's incredible.
Yeah, he's just – and at that – age, I mean, he had the best rookie season for a point guard since Chris Paul, and maybe one of the best ever. It's like him, Chris Paul, and Magic Johnson were the best rookie seasons ever for point guards. And Ian's got something going up later today. Hopefully it'll be up before this podcast, where Gary Payton talks about his top five point guards in the league, and he has Kyrie Irving on that list. Gary Payton does. I think he had him at fifth. Where do you think he ranks in the continuum of point guards right now?
Oh, God.
And I know we're ranking things and point guards. It's always so difficult. But I'm putting you on the spot anyway.
You can even
give a range. You know, like you could say, oh, he's top 5 to 10. I'm okay with that.
Top 7, like max. Like at the very least, he's top 7.
So you're saying he's definitely in the top 7, or the best he can be is top 7?
No, I'm saying he's definitely in the top 7, and I think 7th is his basement.
Of right now, 7th is his basement. You think there's?
Yeah, I'm saying like if you're arguing right now, you're saying what I think, you know, 7th is like maybe the worst you could say he is.
Even with his, you know, mostly atrocious defense, you'd say that?
Yeah, I'm still going to say that. Because
his offense is just that good. Like he's
his offense
so
is just
good.
That good, but also I'm putting the fun factor in here. And there aren't many players more fun to watch than Kyrie Irving. His dribbling, his handles are just gorgeous. They are a gift from above.
That's what I wanted to talk about next, was the next thing I was going to bring up about him. I wrote something about him last season for Hoop Chalk where I broke down basically his isolation game. Just because it's so much fun to watch him shake guys up. And, like, I wrote about this. I don't think I've ever seen any player dribble between his legs more than Kyrie. And it's not like he does it like some guys do just to, like, be fancy. He does it with such purpose. Like, every between-the-legs dribble, it's like he's measuring up how the defender reacts to each sway, each side to side, and then he just kind of explodes in one direction or the other, or he just goes right from that between the legs dribble into a jumper. It's really incredible to watch, especially when you're just watching it on a loop and you see how often he really does it. It's amazing.
You know who he reminds me of? And of course I'm going to find a way to bring it back to him. Brandon Roy. And because Roy, like, he didn't have flashy handles. Like, Kyrie has flashy handles, but they're also, like, very controlled handles. But, like Jamal Crawford has flashy handles. He has very good handles, but they're also really flashy. Roy had terrific handles. Like, he was a terrific dribbler, but he was never very flashy. But just the moves that he executed, there were ones, like, you wouldn't think from him that he'd be able to do just because of his size and his stature. He's not, like, all that athletic.
I mean, I can see it, but I think Roy had kind of more power in both his dribbling and his driving, where Kyrie is more of a...
graceful.
He's like acrobatic.
They both glide, is what I'm saying. Like, they glide with their dribble. The ball is an extension of their hand, of their body. It's Chris Paul and Steve Nash-ish in the way that's, it's, you know, when they're dribbling, it's not a ball. It's just an extension of their hand. It is... there will be done with that ball.
I can see where you're going, kind of, with the Roy comparison, but I'm not fully on board just because I think that it's like they move differently.
No, that's fair. That's fair. But it's just, it kind of reminds me of it a little bit. But, I mean, I don't think there's, like, more enjoyable highlights of Kyrie. Like, yeah, his scoring's fine, but, like you're saying, like, just watching his dribbling on loop, like, when he, like, shook the entire Team USA defense. That's one of my favorite videos to just watch over and over again.
He did to the Knicks last year. I mean, it was just absurd.
Yeah.
He was dribbling up and down the left side of the court, and he, like, I think Jason Kidd's pants fell off. It was so bad. It was like, even just watching, I was like, this is incredible, you know? And I'm a Knicks fan. I didn't even care. It was just that amazing.
Right, you can't be mad at that. You have to be happy that you got to witness
it. Right, exactly. That's exactly what it is. But let's talk about his backcourt mate, though, Dion Waiters. Obviously, very controversial player, I'd say.
A divisive character, yes.
Yes, you know, I would say mostly it's Cavs fans that are convinced that he's, you know, great. And there are others who are saying, well, what does he do well? And the answer most often is not that much yet.
I also just think he's not the ideal complement for Kyrie. And I think he may be best suited as a sixth man. Which, let's be clear, like, a sixth man is not a bad role. It's not some sort of demotion. Whenever someone says, like, I think his best role is a sixth man, it's like, no, he's better than that. It's like, sixth man is a very good role. Sixth man is one of your most important players. Like, that's a good thing if he turns out to be that weapon.
Right. I mean, Manu Ginobili's been a sixth man almost his whole career. James Harden was a sixth man for a while. You know, it's not an insult.
More important than than some of the starters.
Right. I mean, sometimes that guy, there's a guy that his skill set just demands that he's the leader of the second unit rather than, you know, the second or third or fourth guy on the first unit. And I thought that about Waiters, you know, even prior to last year. But I think that last year someone somewhat reinforced it a bit. But and Conrad wrote about Waiters, a really long piece for Fear of the Sword, about the ways he was used and how it wasn't conducive necessarily to him having much success. You know, as a rookie guard, he ran something like the second or third highest percentage of pick and roll plays of any shooting guard in the league.
And that's ridiculous. Like, that's not his skill set.
Right, and he was rarely used as either a spot-up shooter or off-screens, which is a situation where he would have someone else creating for him. But then, you know, you think about what people were talking about as Deion Waiters' strengths coming into the draft, and it was all, oh, he can create for himself. That was, like, the big draw about Deion Waiters.
Maybe.
Right, I mean, he was not even a necessarily a good shooter in college, really.
No, he wasn't. His rise of the draft boards, tears, it was just one of the most bizarre things.
I feel like that happens with so many Syracuse players.
It does.
It happened with Wes Johnson. It happened with Johnny Flynn. It even happened with Fab Mello, where he was like miraculously a first-round pick.
The most fabulous Mello.
He's not really that fabulous, actually.
He's not that fabulous.
He's not that fabulous at all. But I mean, let's keep going on Waiters a little bit. By the end of the season, he actually shot 40% from mid-range, 40.1. Which is somewhat shocking to me.
I wouldn't have thought that. But still, like.
But then he also shot 51% in the restricted area, which is just, I mean, it's awful.
Right.
But I'm pretty sure that improved month to month over the course of the year.
He did get better. Like, that's what you can say about him. And that's good. That's promising. It's just you have to wonder if they're going to see that maybe it's like that's maybe not the best role for him, because you don't want to have two ball dominant guards in the backcourt, especially one where like you want the ball in Kyrie Irving's hand as much as possible.
Right, and but the thing is, I feel like a lot of people were talking about that as a draw of playing Irving and Waiters together before last season. Like, oh, you need more than one guy that can create. And I do think that that's true somewhat, but you also need that second creator to be a guy that can, when the first, you know, penetrating option is the one with the ball, that second guy needs to be able to draw defenders away. Whereas I don't really think Waiters can do that well, because you don't have to really respect his shot from outside that much.
No, we don't yet. And maybe that's something he works on, and he probably will. And he likes to shoot the ball. That's very apparent.
Deion Waiters does like to shoot the ball. That's for sure. You know what? I've found that throughout this process so far, we've been coming up with, you know, very apt descriptors for people. Like, we had Jeff Green, not the worst X. Or was it not the worst, or not a terrible?
I think it was not a terrible.
Right. Jeff Green was not a terrible. Deion Waiters likes to shoot the ball. let's move on to, like, they hired Mike Brown back again as their coach. They're running it back with Mike Brown. And, I mean, their huge problem last year was the defense. Obviously, Varejão coming back is going to help that, provided that he's healthy. But I think a lot of what they're counting on is just, oh, Mike Brown's coaching the team now, so the defense is going to be good. But the thing is, with the exception of a couple of those seasons with LeBron, the Cavs weren't great on defense under Brown. And then when he went to the Lakers, they weren't great on defense at all. I'm not sold that Mike Brown is some mastermind defensive coach, that his teams are automatically going to be good on defense.
Do you think it was a lateral move going from Russell to Brown?
You mean from Scott to Brown?
From Scott to Brown.
No, I think it's a step up, just because it's not Byron Scott. I am not a Byron Scott acolyte. Especially, he's not necessarily really gotten along with his point guards that much.
You've seen a pattern of the deteriorating relationship.
Which is never good when your best player is a point guard, which has been in the case on all three of his teams, Byron Scott.
Right.
Not the greatest luck in the world.
No. I think I like the hire, like you said, because it's not Scott, but also because I just think he's going to help Kyrie Irving improve all around. I know he's overrated as a defensive coach, but I still think he is a decent defensive coach. Probably like better than decent. And as we all know, Kyrie could very much stand to improve on that end. However, he's not very imaginative on offense. And now I just don't know how he's going to use player, like, exactly like Waiters, you're saying, like, I don't know how he's going to use him, if he's still going to use them the same way, or if he's going to try in different areas, how he's going to utilize Bennett and Thompson and Varejão. I think it was a fine hire. I don't know who else they would have gone out and gotten, but I also don't think it was the, even though it was fine, I think there could have, I would have liked to have seen them gotten like a development coach. I think I'm a very big believer in that there are certain coaches and right coaches for certain times in a franchise's evolution. Like Scott Brooks right now, we may not think he's a great coach, but I do think he was a good coach for the Thunder when they needed him a few years ago when they needed to develop Durant and Russell Westbrook. Now maybe he's outlived his usefulness on that end, but I think back then he was a good hire for the development of the team.
That makes sense. I understand that, and that certainly those guys have developed under Brooks.
What I would have liked is Brown. I don't think he's that good of a development coach.
Right, and what I would have liked to have seen the Cavs do was like conduct an actual coaching search. Like, I hate when these teams get rid of a coach and then like 3 days later they have a new coach. Like, it's just they settle, not necessarily settle, but they target the one guy and
that's it. You're right.
Like, they just target the one guy, and that's the guy, and that's it. And they don't give anybody else a chance to, you know, kick open the door or impress them in any way and come up with, you know, a coherent plan for how the guys should best be used. And I think it happens too much where teams don't conduct a real coaching search.
Right. No, I agree with you.
Let's move on from there and go to the Pistons.
Wait, hold on. There's one thing we need to mention.
Okay.
Tristan Thompson switched shooting hands.
Yes, Tristan Thompson is now right-handed. I think we can leave it there.
Yeah.
Let's move on to the Pistons. The Pistons made some moves this summer. Joe Dumars with cap space. You know, it's always an adventure. So they signed Josh Smith to, I think, a deal that paid him about $16 million a year. 4 years, $64 million, something like that.
Yeah.
No, 4 years, $56 million. What was Josh Smith's contract? $54 million.
Yep.
He's gonna, you know, have to play some small forward a bit, and their spacing is gonna be horrible when they have him and Monroe and Drummond on the floor at the same time. But also, he's gonna drastically improve their defense and their playmaking. You know, Josh Smith is a very underrated passer. And let's you know, get it out there. Josh Smith is a very good player. You know, a lot of people are laughing at the Pistons because of the concerns about how he fits with the team, but that doesn't mean that Josh Smith is not really good. Like, he upgrades the level of their talent so much.
He does, obviously, but I don't know if, like, I don't think it makes him a better team. Like, again, if you have Drummond and Greg Monroe up front,
I don't see any way how it doesn't make
him very bad. You put Josh Smith at three, that's still very bad spacing, especially considering Smith loves to launch long-range twos and three-pointers, which he has no business shooting. Maybe they want to use him more as like a facilitator on offense because he's a very good passer, very underrated in that regard. So maybe they put him at the elbows, maybe they put him in the corners, and they try and run stuff through him. And that's that's fine, but I don't think you want to do that for, you want your $54 million player to do that. I don't know. I'm kind of writing this in the preview that, like, we learned last year the value of space. We saw it, how valuable it was for Miami, for Houston, and for San Antonio. And then on the other end, we saw what happens when you don't have it with the Grizzlies, who were suffocated because they didn't have a guy who could space the floor, or they didn't have a guy who was playing more than 10 minutes who could space the floor. And the Pistons may get by on talent alone in the playoffs, but maybe they're an 8th seed, maybe they're a 7th seed, something like that. Where are you getting your shooting and your spacing from, and where is the rest of your offense going to come from when those options are cut off?
Listen, I agree with all that, and I mean, you know I do. I'm huge on, you know, you have to develop the space of your offense. I talk about it all the time. But I don't, like, just, you know, when you started there, you said you don't think it makes them better. I'm sorry, I don't think there's any way that them signing Josh Smith doesn't make them better.
No, I'm sorry. You're there right. It does make them better. It gives them more talent and makes them better. I just don't know if it. I don't know how I'm trying to say this, but it's, I just don't think it was good team wise because it's just a bad fit.
Well, let's also bring it here. I mean, how many minutes a game do you think the three of them are going to be on the court together at the same time? I'm thinking it's like 15 minutes at the most.
You think so?
Yeah, I mean, I figure they'll start both halves together with the three of them playing, you know, together. But then, you know, the first sub's going to come in like 6-7 minutes into the half each time. And then maybe they don't play together again until the very end of the half. So it's like, you know, 15 to 18 minutes a game. And the other, you know, 33 minutes or whatever it is, they don't have the massive spacing problem. But you obviously want to get your most talented players on the court, and those three are definitely, I would say, they're the three most talented players on the team. But it's not like they're playing all 48 minutes together and it's just going to be a spacing suck on the team the whole game.
That's true, but also you got to remember that, like, bench play doesn't matter as much in the playoffs. So if they do go to the playoffs, I think that's it's actually going to be more of a concern there.
Well, spacing is more of a concern for every team in the playoffs.
I know, but I'm saying, like, the starters are going to play more minutes in the playoffs.
Sure. Hey,
we don't know what Mochik is going to do, which, again, we'll probably get to that in a minute. But, I mean, then you also look at who's coming off the bench for them. Will Bynum will come in. We haven't gotten a great inning, so I'll stick to the front court. Charlie Villanueva has been a waste. And Yurebko is kind of sort of regaining his form. Tony Mitchell, I'm not sold on at all. The guy who would probably come in for Smith, or maybe as a small ball four, is Singler. I like Singler. I like him as a spacer. He also got Luigi and Tony. But yeah, it's just, they just don't have that much front court depth.
Well, the Tome guy was supposedly a shooter, right?
Yes, he is.
And then they also have Caldwell Pope, who's a shooter as well.
Yeah, I'm just leery of depending on a rookie as your, like, primary or, like, one of your primary sources of spacing.
Hey, they also have the great Chauncey Billups.
Yeah, do they start Billups, do you think?
I mean, probably.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's Mo Cheeks coaching.
Yes.
So I would say that they're probably going to start Chauncey Billups.
Should we talk about that? Should we talk about the Mo Cheeks hiring?
I mean, I think we have to. You know, it was a big part of their summer. Obviously, you know, Lawrence Frank is gone now, so maybe the shackles are off Andre Drummond a little bit. But I'm not necessarily sure how much more leeway Mo Cheeks is going to give him.
I'm not sure how much more leeway he gives him, and I'm not sure how much better of a coach he is than Lawrence Frank.
What do you mean? You're not sold on the guy who coached underwhelming Blazers and Sixers teams?
I know. It surprised me, right? Even though he did win Coach of the Year once.
Did he really?
He did.
Where?
With the Sixers.
No way.
I think he did. I'm probably completely wrong.
I think you're lying. I'm not even saying you're wrong. I think you're lying.
Oh, I'm sorry. For some reason, I thought he did.
Yeah, you're lying.
I'm lying. I apologize to everybody out here. I thought that he did.
Yep, you're wrong.
Yeah, there's
but
no
he has spent the last 4 years as an assistant with the Thunder. And, I mean, Scott Brooks, not necessarily the best guy to learn under, but he has been around good players, which is nice.
I'm still pissed. I thought he won Coach of the Year. What's wrong with me? You know what? It's because I haven't slept in an actual bed in, like, 3 days.
Yep. Well, we're not absolving you of blame. Sorry.
You shouldn't. Yeah. I'm going to go flail myself after this with a nine tails. Anyways.
I don't know what that means. Let's
He's learned under the Thunder. He's learned under Scott Brooks, but it's like, again, like Scott Brooks.
Cheeks. Another thing the Pistons did this summer was they traded Brandon Knight and maybe somebody else, I can't really remember honestly, for Brandon Jennings. They swapped Brandon's and they got a very bricktastic player. But also one who I think kind of, I'd say he reads the court a little better than Brandon Knight. He's not necessarily a more willing passer, but he's a more creative one.
He's more creative, and I think he just knows how to pass better.
Right. And it's like he can get to different places on the court that Knight can't, I'd say.
No, I agree. I think he knows how to play that position better than Brandon Knight does. And Brandon Knight was always a point guard, not necessarily an experiment, but he was a guy you had to teach the position to. Brandon Jennings was always a point guard. He may not have always been a pass-first point guard. He still is not a pass-first point guard, but he's shown the ability to dish the ball very well.
Yes. My favorite part about them getting Jennings and Josh Smith is how they now have three lefties in the starting lineup. They're tied with the Grizzlies for the most lefties in a starting lineup in the league.
Well, that's exciting.
Yeah. And as a lefty, lefties, it's very exciting to me to be represented by the Motor City.
Hey, it's exciting to me too. I'm a lefty.
You're a lefty? How did I not know this?
I don't know. I am, though.
Are you lying? Again, you just lied about Mo Cheeks.
I'm not lying about this.
All right. Well, I mean, I think that there was one more Pistons-related thing I wanted to talk about. Okay, this was it. They're just in such a tough division.
Yeah.
Like, the Central Division is so good.
Which is weird because it's, you know, the East, and we don't usually think that the East is good, but there's that one division is. It's right. The one good one.
Although I really think it's more, they have Indiana and Chicago, so they have two really, really good teams, whereas the other divisions have one in the Southeast as Miami is the only really good team, and the Atlantic, you never know what's going to happen with the Knicks and the Nets. Like, they could be really good or they could just be good. You know what I'm trying to say?
You're not worried about Boston, Philadelphia, or Toronto.
Right. Boston, Philadelphia, and Toronto are not going anywhere. I mean, Atlanta's the second best team in the Southeast, I'd say. And then, you know, we're going to talk about Washington next. But those aren't teams that are going to, you know, threaten for the conference finals, whereas the Central has two teams that will definitely be threatening for the conference finals.
And they're also the best defensive teams in the league, too.
The Atlantic has two teams that could threaten for the conference finals, but the Central has two teams that definitely will threaten for the conference finals, I'd say.
Yes.
And then, you know, Detroit-wise, again, they got Peyton Siva. I just like him. I think he's a good ball pressure guard, and he can run a team a little bit. You saw it when he was at Louisville. Do you like him? I mean, I know he was. I think he was an undrafted free agent. I think
he was undrafted. I saw him, or he was either undrafted or he was in the second round. But I saw him.
Second, 26th pick of the second round.
There you go. I saw him in Orlando, and I sat with Brett Corminus, Grantland, and Groupspeak, and a few other places. I sat with him a lot during Orlando, and he really liked Siva. You know, he was saying that Siva helps you because he can see the floor really well, but also his speed, his diminutive size is actually kind of helps him a little bit in that regard. It's almost like Berea-ish in a way. I like Saban. I think he's fine. I'm never going to ask him to run my team.
No, I mean, I don't think he's great or anything. He's a nice player. I like him.
He's a nice player. He's a good defender too. I like him on defense. I just like the way it's going to sound, very flowery, but I like the way he interacts with his teammates. Like, he was hurt for one or two games, but he was still engaged with the coaches, still wanted to know what was going on, what people were doing wrong, what they were doing right, still trying to help out other players. I like him as a team player.
I mean, I didn't see that because I make it a practice to not watch Summer League.
It's horrible.
It's such bad basketball. I just can't do it.
It's horrible. I watched
a half of Knicks Pelicans, and that was like the first Summer League I've watched in, I don't know, 5 years or something like that. I also like Will Bynum as a backup point guard too. He's just solid. I think he's exactly what you look for in a backup point guard, just a guy who's not going to kill you and can kind of be a caretaker of the second unit.
Yes, I completely agree. I've always liked Will Bynum. He's never going to be spectacular. But he's your quintessential backup point guard. Sometimes he's going to have those games where he goes off. He gives you a bunch of points. He's never going to be – he's not a good shooter. But he's very good at getting into the lane. He's a good pick-and-roll player. Patrick Hayes last year – or it was in March – had a really good why we watch on Will Bynum on the Classical last year. So go and check that out.
On the other hand, I am not a Rodney Stuckey guy.
Nope, me neither.
I mean, this guy takes a lot of shots for a guy that can't shoot that well.
Yep.
You know, I mean, it's concerning. I mean, he's a talented player. He can do a bunch of different things. He's a pretty good rebounder for his size. And when given the chance, he's been a decent distributor as well. You know, I mean, he averages 4.2 assists a game for his career. In 29 and a half minutes a game, but I would say he's one of those guys that's too confident in his own ability to get a basket.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think it's also kind of a thing where it's almost a culture thing. Like, you're not sure what he is for your team. Like, when he was picked, people thought he was going to be like, that hybrid, what was then in vogue, point guard, shooting guard, that combo guard. He's going to be a franchise player, and he had a decent rookie year, but then it's like, turns out he's not all that good. He didn't progress all that much.
He's kind of Ben Gordon-ish, and they just Ben traded Gordon-ish. Ben Gordon a couple years ago.
I like that.
He's Ben Gordon-ish. Rodney Stuckey is Ben Gordon-ish. We're doing really well with these narrowing guys down to one thing.
And we're terrific.
I think that the entire internet would kill us if we didn't talk about Andre Drummond and our girl, Jeanette McCurdy, who took over the HP email thread yesterday. There was like 25 straight emails that were just about her.
She swarmed it. And you can go ahead and talk about this because I honestly have no clue who she is.
I did not know who she was until AP wrote the thing about her on HP. I had no idea who she was, and I read that. It was great. And then Andrew Sharp has been keeping track of it extensively at Grantland, and that's the extent of the things that I know about her. I actually asked Sean on GChat one day. I was like, hey, who is this girl that Andre Drummond's with? He's like, oh, she's on iCarly. And I was like, what's iCarly?
What is an iCarly, please?
Right. I was like, who's Carly? But she wrote a really interesting article in the Wall Street Journal yesterday about kind of like the trappings of fame as well as the trappings of the internet and social media. And it was about her budding relationship with Andre Drummond, it was a very interesting piece. It was very well written. I was very impressed. She's a good writer and apparently a talented actress, or at least an actress that was on a popular show. I've never seen anything she's been in, so I can't say whether or not she's talented, but we'll give her the benefit of the doubt.
And if she's listening, she is absolutely welcome to come on Podcast Proxies or Proxy Vision. Just throw that out.
We would absolutely welcome that, and I would be happy to watch a show or movie that she's in beforehand so I can speak with authority about whether or not she's actually talented, which I'm sure she is. Andre Drummond would not be, you know, going after some untalented actress, I don't think.
Right. If she agrees to come on the show, Jared and I will have a iCarly marathon watch party.
I don't know about that. I'd watch an episode.
No, you already agreed to it.
All right, I agree to it. We'll have a marathon. Not that this is going to happen, but we'll do it. There was also yesterday, and I think a new guy, Scott Crab Dribbles, sent it out on the thread. Somebody said, oh, I'm worried about Drummond because he's going to be distracted by this girl. And she was like, no way, we both have stuff to do. I thought that was really funny. I thought that was very funny. But good for them. They met on the internet, and they seem to be happy, I guess. I don't really know much about it other than they're dating, maybe. And she wrote about it, and they take pictures. Good for them. Good for them, you know?
Yeah.
Good for Andre Drummond. He's following in the footsteps of Quincy Pondexter, picking up girls on Twitter.
John Hollinger still had one of the best tweets when that happened, when her and Quincy Pondexter, like, asked out or whatever. Hollinger just tweeted Quincy Pondexter with the ultimate heat check.
Oh, yeah. That was great. And I mean, it was, but I think it worked for him. I think he got a date out of it with, like, Miss Tennessee or whoever it was.
It did work.
Right. And then there was, like, the Pondextering hashtag, which was funny. I think we can move on now. We're going to move on to the Wizards.
Probably the best team of this three.
I think so, too. And after John Wall came back last year, they looked like a playoff team for most of that time that Wall came back.
No question. They were top, I think they were top, what, six something in defensive efficiency.
That was almost all season, though. They were really good on defense the whole year.
Well, I know, but it was just like seeing that what John Wall did, like, to an already pretty good defense. Like, he comes back, he elevates it, like, that much more. And then you got to figure you give him a full season with that offense. You got Bradley Beal, who really picked it up once John Wall came back as well.
Right. I was about to go to that. Wall raised Beal's level of play so much. So much.
I mean, Beal before, we both wrote about this. Before Wall, he was shooting, I think, like, from the corners, he was shooting he was sub 35%. From three, from the corners. Wall comes back, and he's hitting...
It was somewhere around, like, 50% of his corner threes. It was something absurd.
Yeah, absolutely absurd. And while those numbers aren't going to hold, you got to think, for an entire season, that's still, like, it shows you what those two can do together on the court.
Yes. And I think Mike Prada tweeted something out a couple weeks ago. Something like 19% of Wall's assists were for corner threes, which is insane.
It's terrific, too.
And that kind of holds with the pattern he established in the first couple of years of his career as well. 2 years ago, or sorry, not this past year, the year before the lockout season, he led the league in total assists for corner threes. And then again last year, he had a bunch of those. Just quickly, in 25 games together, 458 minutes that Wall and Beal played together, the Wizards outscored their opponents by 8.8 points per 100 possessions. They scored at the level of a top 12 offense, and they defended at what would have been a top 3 level.
Yeah, and that's why you give them that contract.
Yeah. Like, yeah, well, I mean, not just that. You know, there's
a lot. Not just that, but it's like, yeah, there are health concerns about Wall, and he really needs to change his running style so he's not landing on his knees and thereby landing on his ankles and thereby impacting his, you know, entire leg and back and knee and whatever. That being said, the guy is already a very good point guard. He can't shoot. He still very much needs to work on his shooting. Shot only 26% from three last year. And not a good shooter. But he's already a very good distributor. He's one of those, like, distributors. Like, he averaged 8.4 assists per 36 minutes last year.
Right. It's crazy to me when people used to say, like, oh, he doesn't have that great court vision. Like,
he has very good court vision. Did you see his pass? I mean, this was it's not an example of quarterback vision, but did you see his pass to Blake Griffin in the rookie game? That's still one of my favorite passes of all time.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Again, that doesn't demonstrate his court vision, but no,
it
doesn't. Yes.
But it demonstrates that he's fun. He's another fun player. He's blindingly fast. But again, we still haven't had really a full healthy season from him. He played every game during the lockout shortened season, 66 games. But again, we haven't had an 82 games from him or like something.
Also, quickly, you know, just before we move on, yes, Wald, not a great shooter from outside, but I want to point out that he did raise his mid-range field goal percentage last year to 37.8%. And then, you know, the most of those mid-range shots came from the right elbow, where he made 52 out of 106 shots.
Yeah, I don't know if you have that information, but was that like, did those come like off of, like from screens or such?
That's what I'm thinking. I mean, unless I watched them all right now, I wouldn't be able to tell. Mm-hmm. But what I'm thinking is he worked on that kind of right elbow pull-up off the pick and roll is what I'd guess. And I mean, that does sound right from, you know, the tape that I've watched of him. I haven't necessarily watched specifically to see whether those shots are that kind of shot, but it fits with how, you know, I've watched him before.
And that's going to be huge. Like, that's going to be huge to his development as a pick and roll player and just like as the offense overall, because if he becomes a threat from there, then like that's what he needs to do is just become a threat.
Right, and obviously, you know, you'd like him to improve his outside shot from the three-point line as well. But it's not like you can't be an effective point guard and not be a great shooter from three.
Look at Rajon Rondo, yeah.
Right, or, I mean, even Chris Paul the last few seasons hasn't been a great three-point shooter.
That and Tony Parker, too. Like, Tony Parker's raised his percentages, but you're never going to think of him as, like, a three-point. He's not a three-point.
And obviously, Paul and even Parker are much better shooters than Wall. But, I mean, you look at Paul last season shot 32.8% from three. You know? Also, the Wizards, they drafted Otto Porter, who I really like. Like, I think that 1-2-3 of Wall, Beal, and Porter, they could keep those guys together for a long time. That's a really nice. And it just fits well, like that they do things that complement each other.
Yep. I thought Porter was such a great pick for them. He's such a great fit. Yeah, he struggled a lot in summer league.
Doesn't matter.
Right? No, it doesn't matter. And like, so what? He's still going to develop. He's going to develop alongside these players. He's going to be with for a long time. That's key.
And I think also a key is they don't need him to be, you know, a great player. Right away, if ever. He doesn't need to be great. He just needs to be solid and good. But, you know, they have Martell Webster still to play the three, who's been one of the better 3-and-D guys in the league the last couple of years. So I think that helps Porter's development as well, where he can just concentrate on doing the things that he does well when he comes in the game, and he doesn't have to be, you know, a core cornerstone guy yet.
Yes, I agree. Their front court, then... they have Okafor and Nene up front, and like none of those two guys are going to be around long term. Nene probably.
Well, I think Okafor's contract expires this season.
Yeah,
and so does Trevor. Or did they get rid of Ariza?
No, he's still there.
Right. Okay. So yeah, those guys are up after this year. Okafor and Nene, though, when they played together, the defense. Very good.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, like they were very good on defense all year.
Constructed in terms of their young talent, and then they've got those two guys up front, even though they're not going to be around for, like, as part of the future, like, they're going to help them right now. They're going to help reach the playoffs, which is huge to the development of those younger players, too.
Yes. So let's put this out there. Beal, Nene, Wall and Okafor when they played together. It was only 170 minutes, so small sample size concerns abound, but they outscored opponents by 19.6 points per 100 possessions in that time that they were on the floor together, which is quite good. And then when
what about when you put Vesely in there?
I'm not doing that. I don't care how good he looks in like Eurobasket or whatever. I mean, I've seen people tweeting about it, like, "Oh, Jan Vesely." No, sorry, not doing it. I don't care. The highlight of Jan Vesely's career is going to be
draft.
Right when they showed his girlfriend during the draft. That's the highlight of his career, as far as I'm concerned.
And like, you feel bad, like you read all these profiles and like interviews with the guy, and it just seems like he has no confidence.
I don't read any profiles on Jan Vesely just because I don't care.
Well, yeah, I know that, but I forgot who wrote it. I don't know, I was reading it. It's just like, the guy seems like having no confidence. He's like, he doesn't love the game. Like, he loves the game, but it just seems like the love is out of the form when he plays for the Wizards, which is sad to see.
I don't read too much into that kind of stuff. Like, the he doesn't love the game. Like, it doesn't matter.
No, as long as he plays well. Like, but it's just saying, like, from his quotes, it just seems like he just seems sad. That's what I'm saying.
All right, I mean, fair enough. Washington also signed this summer Eric Maynor, so they finally have a capable backup point guard. They're not throwing Garrett Temple or AJ Price out there. So, you know, that's good. They'll have a guy who can command the second unit offense. Obviously, it won't be as good as when Wall's out there, but it'll be, I mean, last year was a disaster. No matter who played point guard other than John Wall, it was a joke.
How do you like Bradley Beal? I know we already know he's a great shooter, but how do you like him in terms of like putting the ball in his hands as kind of like a secondary operator?
I mean, I think you can put him in some side pick and rolls when he gets a kick out and things like that. Or, you know, let's say he comes off a pin down, but he can run that J.J. Redick action where he comes off a pin down, and if he's not open, you turn it into a pick and roll right away. But I wouldn't necessarily, you know, just place him at the top of the key and have him run the offense.
That's fair. I mean, that's kind of what I was thinking too. He's got really good ball handling ability for his
right.
size.
He's a secondary ball handler, which is fine as your shooting guard.
Yeah.
They also signed this summer former New York Knicks great Al Harrington. I just love the way the Knicks announcer used to say his name. It was like that. I mean, nobody, you know, probably remembers that except me, but it was fantastic. And he gives them another dimension in the front court, I think, just because they don't have guys that are shooters really in the front court. You know, it's Nene and Okafor aren't guys that are going to stress the defense much, but Harrington can do that. And you know, if they decide to go small ball a little bit with Porter or Webster at the four, they can do that as well. It just gives them a different option. And, you know, I think that especially with the second unit, he'll help Maynor on the break because Harrington loves to take that trailer three on the break. Like, he'll just sprint straight to, you know, kind of like the elbow extended on the arc. And he'll just, you know, he'll let it fly. That's Al Harrington.
You're an Al Harrington fan, aren't you?
I do like Al Harrington, surprisingly, because generally players of his archetype I'm not big fans of, but... I mean, Al Harrington just provided so much entertainment in what was such a horrible period of basketball for Knicks fans. Like, he was just fun. That's the only way I could put it. Like, that guy, Al Harrington in 08-09 averaged 21 points a game for the Knicks just because he was allowed to shoot so much. Like, he took 6.5 threes a game. I mean, he shot 30.
How did you not like scratch out your eyes?
He shot 36% on them. It's respectable.
That's very respectable.
I mean, Al Harrington, if he dribbles at all, it's a shot, guaranteed. And if he ever tries to pass, it is a 110,000% guarantee that if he tries to pass off the dribble, the ball will be thrown into the stands.
So he's fun, but not like a Kyrie Irving fun. He's a fun at, oh god, this is horrible.
He's fun in a, wow, this guy takes a lot of shots and sometimes he makes them, and then if he tries to do anything else, it's a train wreck kind of way. Sounds about right. I mean, that's Al Harrington. I mean, he's been doing the same thing for 15 years. It's awesome. All right. So I think that, you know, we've kind of discussed all three teams in this group. Now, I think personally there's only room for two of them in the playoffs because I think the Hawks are definitely going to make it. Not necessarily everyone holds that opinion. But if you were to hold the opinion that only two of these three teams, the Wizards, the Pistons, and the Cavs, will make the playoffs, which two are you putting in there?
Definitely Wizards. I think they're a lock. And then that's a tough choice between Cleveland and Detroit. I'm going to go with Detroit. I probably should go with the Cavs because I shouldn't count out Kyrie. I'm going to go with the Cavs because I don't like Detroit. I just don't like that lineup.
I was going to say, for someone that was so low on Detroit when we talked about them, it's surprising that you would have put them in the playoffs.
Right.
Well, yeah. We filed our ESPN predictions for the summer forecast a few weeks ago. I put the Wizards and Cavs in there. I just don't have confidence in Mo Cheeks to sort things out the right way in terms of their lineups and then also to play Andre McCurdy enough. You like how I slipped that in there?
I did. That was very good of you.
what do you think? Is there anything else you want to talk about relating to these three teams?
No, I think we've done enough.
That's a hell of a way to end the podcast. Next time, we're going to talk about the top six teams in the West. And if you don't know who those teams are, you probably haven't paid much attention to this offseason. But it's the Thunder, the Spurs, the Grizzlies, the Warriors, the Clippers, and the Rockets. See you next time, folks.
Bye.